At first this seemed the logical thing to do, and I had actually taken several steps away from the craft, heading back toward the base, when another thought intervened with a force that brought me to a stop at once. It would take at least 3/4 of an hour for me to get back to the base, report the incident to whomever might still be there on this holiday evening, and to return with them. What if a device had taken off again in the meantime? Since I had no idea of its purpose here, I had no way of guessing how long it might remain, and I had seen how effortlessly it could move. Suppose I did rush back to the base and, half out of breath, gasp out the story of what I had seen? Suppose that a few of my skeptical fellow workers did condescend to follow me back to this spot, only to find a crushed patch of brash where I had said a spacecraft would be found? The mental picture of the position I would be in was so clear and so probable that I immediately dismissed all thought of reporting the advent of this craft, at least until there was a great deal more evidence to back such a report. I had heard something of the ridicule heaped upon those who had been incautious enough to have admitted seeing unexplained objects flying through the air. How much worse would be the lot of one who claimed to have seen one land, and to have been close enough to have touched it, yet had no proof except a small patch of flattened brush. My curiosity still demanded satisfaction, however, and I decided I would learn whatever I could about the craft, and hope that I would survive to make a report at some later date. It occurred to me that I had not as yet actually touched the craft, although I had been close enough to have done so for some time. Perhaps I could learn something of the material of which it was made, and certainly I could tell the temperature. I stepped forward and cautiously extended my index finger until it touched the metal surface. It was only a few degrees above the air temperature, but it had a quality of smoothness that seized my attention at once. It was simply impossible to produce any friction between my fingertip and the metal. No matter how firmly I pressed my finger on the metal, it drifted around on the surface as though there were a million tiny ball bearings between my finger and the metal. I then began to stroke the metal with the palm of my hand, and could feel a slight but definite tingling in the tips of my fingers and the heel of my palm. Then a crisp voice suddenly broke the silence. "Better not touch the hull, pal, it's still hot." I had not fully realized the degree of tension I was under until this totally unexpected voice triggered my reflexes. I leapt backward several feet, caught my heel in a low bush, and fell backward at full length in the sand, in as undignified a position as it is possible to imagine. I heard something that sounded like a low chuckle, then the voice came again, this time in a somewhat friendlier tone. "Take it easy, pal, you're among friends." The humiliation of my ungraceful posture, combined with the mild tone of the voice and its familiar phrases, served to sweep away the momentary fear, and replaced it with a slight resentment. I arose, brushed off my clothes, and tugged at a sand burr that had found a home in my hair. I looked for some person or gadget from which the voice might come, but could find neither. "You could have turned the volume down a bit," I grumbled. "You scared me out of a week's growth when you blasted out like that."
"Blasted out?"
The voice hesitated. "Oh yes. You mean the amplitude of the warning was too great. Sorry buddy, but you were in the process of killing yourself and there wasn't time to diddle with controls."
"Do you mean the hull is highly radioactive?"
I asked. "If so, I am still much too close."
"It isn't radioactive in the sense that you use the word," was the reply. "I use the term hot because it was the only one I could think of in your languages to explain the condition. The hull has a field about it which repels all other matter. Your physicists would describe the force involved as the antiparticle of the binding energy of the atom. When certain elements such as platinum are properly prepared and treated with a saturation exposure to a beam of very high energy photons, the anti-binding energy particle will be generated outside the nucleus. Since these particles tend to repel each other, as well as all other matter, they, like the electron, tend to migrate to the surface of the metal where they manifest as a repellent force. The particles have a fairly long half-life, so that the normal cosmic radiation received by the craft when in space is sufficient to maintain an effective charge. The field is very powerful at molecular distances but, like the binding energy, It follows the seventh power law so that the force becomes negligible a few microns away from the surface of the hull. Perhaps you notice that the hull seemed unusually smooth and slippery. That is because your flesh did not actually come in contact with the metal but was held a short distance from it by the repulsion of the field. We use the field to protect the hull from being scratched or damaged during landings. It also lowers air friction greatly when it becomes necessary to travel at high speed through any atmosphere. The field produces an almost perfect laminar flow of air or any gas about the craft, and little heat is generated or transmitted to the hull. But how would this kill me? I asked. I did touch the hull and felt only a slight tingle in my hand. And what did you mean by that remark about my language? You sound pretty much American to me. As to your first question, the voice replied, it would not have killed you at once. In fact, it might have taken several months, but it would have been just as certain as if it had been instantaneous. The best way to explain the effect is to say that exposure of the skin to the force field causes it to produce what you would describe as antibodies in the bloodstream. The antibodies are absorbed by the liver, whose function they attack, causing the liver to become greatly enlarged and congested. Exposure above certain limits will completely destroy the liver's function. In your case, the exposure was so short and over such a small area that you are not in any great danger, although you will probably feel some effects sooner or later. Provided, of course, that your biological functions are similar to ours, and we have good reason to believe they are. As to your second question, I am not an American such as you, nor even an Earthian, although my present assignment requires me to become both. The fact that you believed me to be one of your countrymen is a testimonial to the effort I have expended to learn and to practice your language. If you talked with me for any length of time, however, you would begin to notice that my vocabulary is far from complete, and many of my words would seem outdated and perhaps obsolete. As a matter of fact, I have never yet set foot upon your planet. It will require at least 4 more of your years for me to become completely adapted to your environment, including your stronger gravity, your vitiated atmosphere, and your myriad of deadly biotics. I will also require the complete cooperation of someone like yourself, who is already a resident of the planet. I stood silently for what seemed a long time, attempting, without too much success, to digest the full meaning and implication of the words. At last I said slowly, if anyone else had described to me the things I have seen and heard tonight, I would have said they had been reading too much science fiction. As it is, I am prepared to accept the possibility of almost anything. In any event, since my being here and seeing you land was entirely accidental, it is obvious that my belief or disbelief could not be of the slightest concern to you. On the contrary, replied the voice, it is important to us that you be given every opportunity to acquaint yourself with the facts and to form your opinion accordingly. One of the purposes of this visit is to determine the basic adaptability of the Earth's peoples, particularly your ability to adjust your minds quickly to conditions and concepts completely foreign to your customary modes of thought. Previous expeditions by our ancestors, over a period of many centuries, met with almost total failure in this respect. This time there is hope that we may find minds somewhat more receptive so that we may assist you in the progress, or at least in the continued existence of your race. Your own mind, for example, seems to be exactly the type which we require, which is why we are speaking with you now. I can see, I said, that your race, whatever it is, and ours has at least one thing in common, that sarcasm is considered a form of humor. However, you can't annoy me that way. In our business we are frequently needled by experts. I realize that everything I have done since you first came into sight has been wrong. In the first place, if I had had any sense, I would have gotten out of here fast when I first saw you coming, instead of waiting, perhaps to be crushed under the ship, or to become a specimen in some museum. When you landed, instead of leaving quietly or remaining at a safer distance, I had to come snooping around your craft. Then, when your warning voice came through your speaker, or whatever it is, instead of reacting to the warning calmly, I jumped like a scared jackrabbit, and assumed what is probably the most undignified position from which the representative of one race has ever greeted the emissary of another. Last, but not least, you seem to assume that I believe the statements you have made. As I said before, I am prepared to consider the possibility that they are true. I am also prepared to consider the possibility that you are pulling my leg and that this whole thing is some huge and complex hoax, for purposes which I can't guess at the moment. The only thing that inclines me toward the first assumption is that I did see the craft come in and land, and I know that, hoax or not, it does represent highly advanced technology. Precisely, replied the voice. Let me explain my position. No sarcasm was intended. I meant exactly what I said. In the first place, you said that curiosity impelled you to investigate the sampling craft, subjecting yourself to unknown hazards rather than to seek safety in flight. This typifies the struggle between the desire for knowledge and the desire for the safety of the status quo. I believe there is an old saying among your people that self-preservation is the first law of nature. It is encouraging to note that the desire for knowledge can occasionally overcome the basic animal instinct. When I called a warning to you, your reaction was not one of fear, as you seem to think. A reaction of pure fear would have frozen you into immobility at least for a moment or two. Instead, you acted instantly and in the proper manner. The fact that you stumbled only indicated that, in your eagerness to learn, you had failed to assure yourself a clear avenue of retreat. The fact that, in spite of being in circumstances completely unique in your experience, you are listening calmly to my voice and making logical replies, is the best evidence that your mind is of the type we hoped to find. Thank you for the compliments, I said, even though I know I don't deserve them. But your statements imply that you propose to use me in some project for the advancement, in one way or another, of the people of Earth. To this I have only one question. Why me? Is it just because I accidentally happened to be here when you landed? I could easily put you in touch with a number of men right here at the test base who could be of far more value to you than I. Perhaps they could, was the reply. But would they? And under what circumstances? These are the critical factors with us. If you think you are here by accident, you greatly underestimate our abilities. Why do you think the dispatcher at your motor pool gave you incorrect information? Why did you think your air conditioning system had failed tonight when, as a matter of fact, it was functioning perfectly? Why do you think you turned off on this small road, when your intention had been to go to your static test stand? And finally, why do you think you changed your mind about going back to your base to report the arrival of our sampling carrier? It is seldom that we superimpose our will upon that of others, in fact our rules forbid it. But this a case of such urgency for your people that we felt an exception to the rule was warranted. To initiate and to carry on our planned program for the welfare, and in fact for the preservation of your people, we will need the complete and confidential cooperation of some member of your race. We believe that you are the individual who can best accomplish the things that must be done. But the decision must be made by you after you have heard our plans. The decision should not be made quickly, nor is there any need to do so. Several of your years will pass before any actual services are required from you. But once your decision to assist us has been made, there are certain preparations which you should make. Assisting in our program will bring you neither fame nor fortune, and may cost you the respect of many of your friends who will misunderstand your actions. Your only reward will be the inward satisfaction of having been of assistance to your fellow men at a very critical time. This is the only reward we expect, and we have come a very long way to offer our services. We will be glad to offer you a short test flight in the sampling craft if it will help you to decide that we are what we say, and that our technology has much for you to learn. I would certainly like to see the inside of your craft, I replied, and I would give anything to be allowed to ride in it. But how does one get in? I have been completely around the thing and saw no sign of opening. Also, you said you were not accustomed to our atmosphere. If I come in, I will have to bring my atmosphere with me. How will that affect you? As I have already mentioned, replied the voice, the craft is a remotely controlled sampling device, or cargo carrier, and while I am speaking through its communication system, I am not in it. I am in a much larger deep space transport ship, or what you would call a mother ship. At present, it is some 900 of your miles above the surface of your planet, which is as close as ships of this size are permitted to approach any planet with an appreciable atmosphere. The cargo craft is being used to bring us samples of your atmosphere so that my lungs may gradually become accustomed to it, since it is I who will, if the project is successful, take up residence upon your planet. All of the previous atmosphere that was in the craft was allowed to escape while it was in space, by the opening of the remotely controlled valve in the top. There is now an almost perfect vacuum inside. When the port is again opened, which I shall do now, your air will rush in to fill the craft, and we will have a large-scale sample of your atmosphere, together with any microorganisms which may be present in it. We need these also, for study and for immunization. Your breathing of the atmosphere during this short demonstration flight will, of course, distort this particular sample somewhat, but we will have ample opportunity to obtain others before my adaptation to the environment of your planet is complete. I will open the intake port now. I heard a sound that was partly a hiss and partly a murmur, coming from the top of the craft. It lasted for about 15 seconds, after which all again became quiet. I was surprised at the small volume of the sound. Any port large enough to have filled a ship of that size with air in 15 seconds should have produced quite a roar. I realized then that the walls of the ship were almost, if not entirely soundproof, and since most of the sound of the entering air would be produced inside, very little would be audible outside. Then I heard a single click come from the lower wall of the craft. A small but sharp click such as might have come from the operation of a single arm relay or a small solenoid. A portion of the lower side of the hull, just to my left, moved back upon itself for a distance of several inches and then moved sideward, disappearing into the wall of the hull and leaving an oval-shaped opening about 5 feet in height and about 3 feet in width at the widest point. I walked over to the port, or hatch whichever it might best be called, and, ducking my head slightly, advanced into the opening. Because of the curvature of the hull, my head was, of course, inside the craft while my feet were still on the ground. The compartment into which I was looking occupied only a small portion of the interior of the ship. It was a room about 9 feet deep and 7 feet wide, with a floor about 16 inches above the ground and ceiling between 6 and 7 feet above the floor. The walls were slightly curved and the intersections of the walls were beveled so that there were no sharp angles or corners. Of course, the wall nearest me, through which the opening led, was the hull itself and had the same curvature inside as outside. This wall was about 4 or 5 inches thick, as I had noticed when I entered through the door or hatch, and it was into a slot in this wall that the door had been drawn. The room contained 4 seats. They looked much like our modern body contour chairs, except that they were somewhat smaller than the ones to which we are accustomed. The seats faced the opening in which I was standing, and were arranged in 2 rows of 2 each in the center of the room, leaving an aisle between the seats and either wall. In the center of the rear wall, where it joined the ceiling, there was a small box or cabinet with a tube and what appeared to be a lenses arrangement. It was somewhat similar to a small motion picture camera or projector, except that no film spools or other moving parts were visible. Light was coming from the lenses. It was not a beam of light such as would have come from a projector, but a diffused glow. While it did not seem particularly bright, it still furnished ample light for comfortable seeing in the small compartment. The seats and the light seemed to be the only furnishings in the otherwise bare metal room. Not a very inviting cabin, I thought, looks more like a cell. As I said before, it's plain, said the voice, it's only a sampling carrier, and was not really designed or intended to carry passengers. The small compartment was designed for emergencies only, but you will find the seats quite comfortable. Step in and take a seat if you wish to make this test flight. Almost automatically I stepped up and onto the floor of the cabin then toward the nearest seat. I had taken only a step when I heard a click as the door began to slide out of the recess in the wall behind me. Instinctively, I turned as though to leap out to the comparative safety of the open desert behind me. But the door was already closed. If this was a trap, I was in it now, and there was no point in struggling against the inevitable. "Where would you like to go?" came the voice again. This time it did not seem to be coming from beside me but rather from all around me, almost as though I was hearing my own voice. "I don't know how far you can take me in whatever time you have," I replied. "And since this compartment has no windows, it won't matter which way we go, as I won't be able to see anything." "You will be able to see," was the reply, "at least as much as you could see from any of your vehicles in the air at night. If you would like a suggestion, we can take you over your city of New York and return you here in about 30 minutes. At an elevation of about 20 of your miles, the light patterns of your major cities take on an especially fascinating appearance which we have never seen in connection with any other planet." "To New York and back in 30 minutes?" I said. "Your minutes must be very different from ours. New York is 2,000 miles from here. A round trip would be 4,000 miles. To do it in half an hour would require a speed of 8,000 miles per hour. How can you produce and apply energies of that order on a craft like this, and how can I take the acceleration? You don't even have seat belts on these seats. You won't feel any ill effects from the acceleration," was the reply. "In fact, you won't feel the acceleration at all. Just take a seat and I will start the craft. I will explain some of the things which seem to puzzle you during the ride." I sat down in the left front seat, which was the one nearest the door, and found it was indeed quite comfortable. The material of which it was made felt like foam rubber with a vinylite covering. However, there were no seams or joints such as an outer covering would require, so the material, whatever it was, probably had been molded directly into its frame in a single operation. Then the voice broke into my thoughts again. "Turn off the compartment light, and activate the viewing beam. Headline, transparent door." For a moment the room became utterly dark. Then the projector again became active. This time it was not a diffused glow but a beam, just as in a movie or slide projector. The beam, or the part of it which was visible at all, was a deep violet, at the very top of the visible spectrum. The beam was focused so as to exactly cover the door through which I had come, and under its influence, the door became totally transparent. It was as though I were looking through the finest type of plate glass or lucite window. There isn't time to give you a complete understanding of all the things you would like to know about this craft and about us. But perhaps I can explain a few of the basic principles about which you seem to be curious, the voice said. I was just beginning to realize that the words which I had been hearing were probably not coming to my ears as sound waves at all but were originating directly in my brain. "As you see," the voice continued, "the door has become transparent. This startles you because you are accustomed to thinking of metals as being completely opaque. However, ordinary glass is just as dense as many metals and harder than most, and yet transmits light quite readily. Most matter is opaque to light because the photons of light are captured and absorbed in the electron orbits of the atoms through which they pass. This capture will occur whenever the frequency of the photon matches one of the frequencies of the atom. The energy thus stored is soon re-emitted, but usually in the infrared portion of the spectrum, which is below the range of visibility, and so cannot be seen as light. There are several ways in which almost any matter can be made transparent, or at least translucent. One method is to create a field matrix between the atoms which will tend to prevent the photon from being absorbed. Such a matrix develops in many substances during crystallization. Another is to raise the frequency of the photon above the highest absorption frequency of the atoms. The beam of energy which is now acting upon the metal of the door is what you would call a frequency multiplier. The beam penetrates the metal and acts upon any light that reaches it in such a way that the resulting frequency is raised to it between the ranges which you describe, the X-ray and the cosmic ray spectrums. At these frequencies, the waves pass through the metal quite readily. Then, when these leave the metal on the inner side of the door, they again interact with the viewing beam, producing what you would describe as beat frequencies which are identical with the original frequencies of the light. As a rough analogy, the system could be compared to the carrier wave of one of your radio broadcasting stations, except that the modulation is applied upstream as it were, instead of at the source of the carrier. For one who has never set foot upon our planet, I said, you have an amazingly complete knowledge of our technology. How is it that you know about our carrier waves and modulation? You are underestimating our technology, was the reply, and you have no idea of the amount of close-range observation to which your planet has been subjected by passing spacecraft during the past few generations. The radio messages and programs which you continually hurl into space can readily be monitored by our receiving equipment, at distances equal to several times the diameter of your solar system. Within such a volume of space there will always be at least a few ships either passing through the system, or pausing to store up energy from its solar radiation. Any data received from earthly broadcasts, which is considered to be of potential interest to other races, will be recorded and relayed to more distant receiving points which will relay in turn, until the data is ultimately available to much of the galaxy. If you are quite ready, we will now begin the acceleration of the sampling vehicle. In spite of the fact that I had been assured I would not feel the acceleration of the craft, I instinctively braced myself in the seat and gripped the sides firmly with my hands. A moment later, the ground suddenly fell away from the ship with almost incredible rapidity. I say that the ground fell away because I did not feel the slightest sense of motion myself, and the ship seemed as steady as a rock. Only through the viewing screen could I see the Earth falling away from beneath the ship. The lights of the army base at the proving ground, which had been hidden by a low hill, instantly came into sight and began seemingly to draw together like a flock of baby chicks when called by the mother hen. A few seconds later the lights of the town of Las Cruces came into view in the lower left-hand corner of the viewing screen, or window, as it might more properly be called, and I knew that we must have risen at least 1,000 feet in those few seconds. The ship was rotating slightly to my left as it rose, and I was also able to see the highway from Las Cruces to El Paso, a narrow but brilliant ribbon, illuminated by the headlights of the countless cars that were upon it. The lights of El Paso and Ciudad Juárez gave out a solid glow on the horizon, but as we continued to rise, they began to break up into patches of varied brilliancy. I could see the hundreds of lights of Fort Bliss, the patch which represented the Presidio area, and the intensely bright spot that was downtown El Paso. I could even distinguish the very thin dark line of the Rio Grande River which separated El Paso from its Mexican twin, Ciudad Juárez. A few seconds later the ship had rotated until the lights of these cities were no longer visible. The viewing screen was now pointed southeast, and apparently the ship had stopped revolving. The surface of the Earth appeared to be glowing with a slightly greenish phosphorescence. The sky outside the ship had become much darker, and the stars seemed to have doubled in brilliance. We must have entered the stratosphere, I thought. If so, we must have risen more than 10 miles in what can't have been more than 20 seconds or so, yet I have not felt the slightest sensation of acceleration. You are now about 13 miles above the surface, I heard the voice say. And you are rising at about 1/2 mile per second. We have brought you up rather slowly so that you might have a better opportunity to view your cities from the air. We will take you up 35 miles for the horizontal flight. At that level the residual atmosphere is attenuated to the point that it can offer but little resistance to the passage of the craft, at the relatively low speed which we will be using. By the way, I said, what happened to the moon? It must be somewhere in the sky, but everything looks so dark outside. It looks dark, was the reply, simply because there is not sufficient atmosphere at this level to diffuse the light. You wouldn't see any evidence of the moon unless it were shining directly in the viewing screen. I have purposely prevented the craft from rotating far enough for this to happen, since the light is quite intense above the atmosphere, and it would be difficult, if not impossible, to see anything else while it was visible. Next headline, electrogravitic propulsion. Now that you are above most of the atmosphere, we can begin to add a substantial horizontal component to your vertical motion. Since there will be little of interest to see during the next few minutes, I will take this time to explain a few of the things that seem to puzzle you. In the first place, you mentioned something about seat belts and questioned whether you could endure the acceleration. This is a question which seems to have come up quite often in the minds of the men of science, and many others of your people. Whenever our sampling devices or landing vehicles have been observed by them, and when the velocities and acceleration are described, disbelief is always apparent.